Good afternoon, and welcome to the third event in our series entitled New Technology in Old Regulatory Framework. My name is Jennifer Schulp, and I'm the Director of Financial Regulation Studies at Cato Center for Monetary and Financial Alternatives. As was on full display at yesterday's House Financial Services Committee hearing on crypto, the regulation of cryptocurrency sits at the intersection of multiple regulatory regimes. Because crypto can alternately be seen as a commodity, a security, a currency, or something else entirely, these overlapping and incomplete regulatory frameworks have drawn criticism from all corners. So, how should crypto be regulated? And by whom? Today's panel continues our consideration of these questions by focusing on the role of the Securities and Exchange Commission. We're honored to be joined today by an experienced panel who can speak to all of the action of the SEC on crypto. There's more to talk about than we can cover in an hour. So without further ado, I'm happy to pass along the microphone to our moderator, David Hollerith, who covers crypto at Yahoo Finance. David?
Thanks, Jennifer. And hello, audience. As Jennifer pointed out, I cover cryptocurrency at Yahoo Finance. And I'm grateful to be moderating the panel because we really couldn't ask for a more exciting time to delve into the relationship between crypto and how securities regulators could or should govern the newer and sometimes mind-boggling asset class. So again, luckily, we're joined by a panel of legal practitioners and thinkers who are engaging with these same topics on a daily basis. So first, I want to welcome Carol Rose Goforth. Carol is a professor at the University of Arkansas School of Law. She has authored Regulation of Crypto Transactions, the first comprehensive textbook on the topic, and also serves as faculty member of the Blockchain Center of Excellence at the University of Arkansas's Walden College of Business. Next, we have Nick Lizardo. Nick advises financial institutions on legal, regulatory, and policy matters as a partner in the international law firm Goodwin Procter. In addition to advising clients in Goodwin's fintech, digital currency, and blockchain group, he also served as at the SEC as counsel to the commissioner Roishman. Our third panelist is Peter Van Valkenburg. Peter is a research director at the Coin Center, a leading nonprofit research and advocacy center focused on public policy issues facing cryptocurrency and other decentralized computing technologies. Peter's also a board member of the Zcash Foundation. And to start, we'll give each panelist an opportunity to deliver an opening statement on the matters at hand. We also encourage the audience to help. During the panel, you can submit questions through Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, and the Cato Institute's website using the hashtag CatoEcon. So for the opening statement, Carol, let's start with you.
All right, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm thrilled to be talking about the SEC's role because I think the SEC, not just in the United States, but around the globe, is probably the most active, the most assertive in promoting the view that a lot of crypto assets are securities and need to be regulated as such. Unfortunately, in my opinion, they have done so without providing clear guidance as to why these things are securities. And while my personal view is that they are taking the approach that virtually every crypto asset is, I can't be sure of that because we have no definitive explanation of which assets are and which assets are not going to be securities. In addition to the issue of whether or not a particular crypto asset is a security, we have the incredibly problematic issue of how to regulate exchanges and how to handle the growing prominence of decentralized finance and crypto in that space. So I'm looking forward to an engaging discussion on the issue of where the SEC is going and where it needs to go.
Thanks, Carol. And Peter?
Yeah, so Coin Center's mission is to defend the freedom to innovate using open blockchain networks. And that focuses primarily on making sure that people who develop the software protocols that power these networks are able to publish their software without prior restraint, without bans on their publication, and making sure that people who want to assemble online, and I do think it's kind of a freedom of assembly question, want to form these peer-to-peer networks by running that software and running the consensus algorithms that the software asks them to run, whether it's proof of work or proof of stake, can do so without, again, prior restraint on that activity. And the SEC's role here is interesting. I think, you know, secondary market regulation is a question that's a little bit adjacent to what I was just describing. You know, there's going to be companies where people make markets for customers and where investor protections can and should reasonably apply. And that doesn't necessarily raise First Amendment issues, raise freedom of innovation issues, as long as it's done in a sensible way with clear guardrails. And I agree with Carol that the guardrails could be clearer. We see enforcement actions against exchanges where the SEC says you were trading securities, but we're not going to tell you which coins you were trading actually are securities and which aren't. And that's not really helpful, even if their mission here is reasonable and they're just trying to do good investor protection. When it comes to issuers, there's this other question. An issuer could be perceived as someone merely running software. And I would argue that that person is not actually an issuer, but the flexible standard for what is a security might be broad enough to encompass somebody just running software if it was interpreted in an uncharitable way. And that's where Coin Center draws the line. We think if you're just running software and just running a computer on the internet to make these networks work, there's no way that you could possibly fit into that flexible standard for issuer of a security. Where it gets much harder is if you did something in addition to that, like solicit investors from early on and promise them the software that would eventually create the future token and promise them some future allocation of future tokens, which brings us to the statement that Chairman Clayton made when he was commissioner, and we've heard echoed by Chairman Gensler, I've never seen an ICO that isn't a security. There's surely some reasonable line where you'd make additional promises in addition to creating your token that bring you into the jurisdiction of the SEC. Where that line falls is hard. Again, from Coin Center's perspective, it can't simply be writing software or running a node. And I look forward to the discussion. Maybe we can sort out that line a little better today. But we've also been trying for a while, so maybe not.
and Nick?
Yeah, hey, great to be here with everybody today. And for those who are patching in virtually, I hope this is a really interesting and spirited conversation today. I'm an attorney. I've been practicing in this space for several years now, and doing so in a couple different capacities. It's been an incredibly exciting space to practice in for a bunch of different reasons. One is that there's a sense of novelty that doesn't come around all that often when you're talking about advising on laws and regulations. And it's also an incredibly dynamic space to be in. There's a lot of energy. There are a lot of new players that, you know, in whether we're talking about the financial services sector or payments or other fintech space, just energy and life that you know, hasn't existed in this way in quite some time. That novelty creates challenges in advising on how to comply with laws and regs. And that's also part of what makes this so fun. For me, you know, when my clients come in and say, hey, what do you think? I'm saying, okay, well, here's the law, here's the regulation, here's how I think you comply with that, here's how I think the steps I think you need to take to actually comply. What has been challenging in this space over the past, call it 5 years, is that there has been this notion of like, come in and talk to us, come in and register with us, the us being the SEC. The dialogue with staff at the agency has been quite robust. And I think that's actually a really big understatement. There have also been numerous attempts to for companies and projects to come in and attempt to register in the categories that exist today. Most of them have been met with not a lot of success. And we'll probably get into a few of those later on. So, you know, I think my big wish as we head into 22 is a little bit further clarity on when the message is come in and register us, how a company or a project goes about actually doing that. And as someone who has, built a career around registering various market participants in the categories that exist, I find it interesting, exciting, but, you know, unfortunately, very challenging to help clients in that capacity right now.
Yeah, that's a great point. I mean, and to sort of start off just a basic question. I'll throw this out to anybody, but you know, the SEC sort of has the Howey test is the guide for whether or not you know, something, a crypto asset as such, is deemed a security. And I was curious if anybody would just sort of walk us through how someone would go about evaluating whether or not a crypto asset is deemed a security by the Howey test. And obviously this is sort of a fool's errand of a question, but I'm curious to sort of talk about it with the panelists.
So, I mean, the background here is the securities laws get passed in the 1930s, and there's a definition of what a security is in those laws. And one of the several things, like bond, equity, things like this, that is in that list is investment contract. So that's a long list from Congress. Congress doesn't define investment contract in the 1930s, and kind of go forward to the speculative real estate boom in Florida and a bunch of other investment schemes. And by the 1950s, we get a case all the way up to the Supreme Court that needs to determine whether this real estate deal being offered by this guy named W.J. Howey in Florida qualifies as a security because it's an investment contract. So the court has to develop a test for what is an investment contract, because again, Congress didn't define it in the statute. And that test is there an investment of money in a common enterprise with an expectation of profits reliant on the efforts of a third party promoter? And you need to check all four of those boxes in order to be a security. Now, obviously, that's a flexible standard. I actually like the Howey test. I might be the only one on our panel, and we can have a good discussion about this, because it's this great example of emergent law to deal with differing circumstances that Congress could have never imagined. So a flexible standard, a principle-based standard, is better than a black letter sort of top-down approach. And so we saw case law from the 50s all the way on that puts a gloss on this. I'll briefly say that there's interesting cases about golf courses. If you offer memberships to a golf course before the golf course is built, that passes the Howey test, because you're relying on the person to actually build the golf course so that it's nice to play on once you actually can play on it. So you're not just wasting your money on a pass to a golf course that's crappy. Excuse me. And then if you sell membership to your golf course that's already built, it's not a security, because there's less of that risk capital, there's less of that expectation of profits and reliance on the efforts of a third party. And so if the Howey test, which was built in the land of orange groves and real estate deals in Florida, that's the 50s case, can be interpreted in the context of golf course memberships, I think it can also be interpreted in the context of cryptocurrency. My problem with what's going on right now is that nobody ever goes to court and fights it out. The SEC would prefer to take parties down that they can easily settle with, get a settlement and get someone to apologize for doing what they do. Settlements don't leave legal precedents. They're not binding on anyone except the two parties that settle, the SEC and say Ether Delta, or the guy who developed Ether Delta. So we need the SEC to go after bigger parties who maybe they're afraid to go after because they know they'll fight it out in court and they'll have good lawyers and a lot of money to spend. And we need those parties to not settle, to say, you know, I'm going to fight this all the way up to the Supreme Court, and then we'll get the clarity with respect to this test. And it'll come from the bottom up. It'll come from a fact-based context, not just someone in Congress or someone in an agency opining from on high about how things should be regulated.
Peter, I think you raised two really good, really important points. One is clarity, and one is, you know, the nature of how many SEC enforcement cases end up being finalized, and it's really through a settlement often, right? Not all the time. And often those settlements are what we call, you know, no admit, no denies, where there's no admission of fault. There's no, you don't get an opportunity to deny that you did anything wrong. You know, there's a notion that the agency's willingness to accept, to, you know, finalize these matters via these no admit, no denies without an admission of wrongdoing, is going to start to be minimized, and that, like, that opportunity to do the no admit, no deny process will be a narrower path for a lot of registrants who come under scrutiny from the SEC. The other part that I think is really interesting is the clarity part. In the settlements that we have seen, at a minimum, I could say typically, but I may even be able to say almost all the time, those settlement orders don't actually identify which particular assets that the SEC thinks were actually securities. And so the industry is unable to really parse, well, okay, well, what do I make of this? I know we know that the SEC thinks that the action or the role that the particular party played was, violative of some law or regulation. But what about the particular instrument or asset that they've been dealing with? How are we to know whether we're doing something wrong? Because we don't know which assets the SEC thinks are in or on the other side are out.
I was going to say that I actually also don't mind the Howey test. I think it's a very important to have in the laundry list of things that are securities, an open-ended category to catch new developments. What I mind is the uncertainty of how Howey applies to crypto assets, because the issues of, are we really expecting efforts, profits based on the efforts of other? Are we looking at the expectation of all of the purchasers? Are we looking at the possible partial motivation of some of the purchasers? How does this apply? And that's what we are lacking. And even if we got an admission of guilt from some participant, that doesn't mean that it's binding on anybody else. Even if we get a trial court opinion, the only place where that's going to be important is in that trial court. Even if we get an appellate division, a circuit court opinion, it's only really relevant in that circuit. You can have splits among the circuit. Even if it goes to the Supreme Court, there's no guarantee that the issue that they focus on is going to be the one that tells us how these tests apply to different kinds of crypto assets. And in a space where we are seeing tremendous variety in the kinds of products that are being issued, that are being developed, it is just so unclear. So we get a test that says, okay, how he applies to this particular crypto asset. What about crypto lending? What about the DeFi platforms or the centralized platforms? What about exchanges? And then once we know it's an asset, the secondary question of, okay, how do I now conduct a compliant offering or a compliant sale or a compliant exchange? Do I have the right disclosures? Do I have the right registration process? What is required of me? I think all of those pieces are missing. And I really wish we could get some congressional guidance, because I think it's going to take so long for this to move through the courts. And I think it takes a tremendous amount of the SEC's attention and resources. In some places I like the idea of having a broad catch-all. In this, I wish we had more definitive guidance so we didn't have to waste so much time getting to a point where there was clarity.
That's an interesting point. Yeah. And in terms of sort of cases that are unfolding, I definitely wanted to get everyone's thoughts on the Ripple case right now. So if we stick with issuers right now, I do want to get to DeFi eventually. But Carol, I think you'd mentioned to me that you often sort of get questions from clients about Ripple. What's going on with the Ripple case right now?
Well, we are waiting for the case to make its way through various procedural arguments. You've got the primary case by the SEC, where they are saying that the XRP is a token. You've got the subsidiary case that was brought by John Deaton, alleging on behalf of, I think the last count was 22,000 Ripple holders that claimed they did not buy it as a security, and the decision by the court to allow him on behalf of those persons to file as an amicus in the SEC's action. I did not think that this was surprising that they would decide XRP was a crypto asset, because in my view, the SEC thinks they're all securities, all crypto assets that are convertible are going to be securities if they want them to be. The under a broad interpretation of how we can go after whatever you want, I think it was regrettable. I don't think the SEC is helping anybody by doing this. I don't I don't think that this was a wise decision. I think it's taking a tremendous amount of attention and time and resources. I think it was detrimental to the system. I think it was detrimental certainly to the thousands of XRP holders. And I don't think it was helpful. I don't think it moves the discussion of what is a security all that much further. Although if we finally get a decision and it's appealed, maybe that will.
Hmm. Carol, you raise an interesting point about private rights of action. So you can have private rights of action with securities law. And as a fan of the common law, and we can talk about this because it's a Cato panel, who thinks that there's wisdom in bottom-up emergent law. The best kind of bottom-up emergent law is when two parties have a dispute and they fight it out, not when there's some central bureau of the government that decides to fight it out on behalf of some imagined wrong or real wrong even, but a wrong that's not personal to them. I haven't heard too many people talk about this. There's a path forward here where the SEC says, look, we're going to offer a brief in any case that makes it up a long way. And there seems to be a lot of questions about the congressional intent behind the securities laws and how we will enforce them. But we're not going to actually be the driver of enforcement. We'll let private parties do that. Because there is this weird situation where sometimes the SEC intervenes in a situation where no one seems unhappy about the investment deal. And that's a little odd. Like, sure, there are information asymmetries that should maybe be corrected through disclosure and things like that. But actually, if all the investors are happy and if the issuer is happy with the money they've gotten from investors, then why do we need to upset the apple cart,
Ironically, if you go back, I don't think there were unhappy investors in Howey either. When the SEC was actually setting out the test, they were SEC to the rescue.
I think Howey was also, I think Howey was actually dead by the time the case actually made it to the Supreme Court too, because that all started back in the crazy real estate days of the 20s and 30s.
Nick, what's your take on all this?
Yeah, sorry, I'm gonna punt on anything on Ripple.
Yeah, fair enough.
The one thing that Peter raised, the idea that you can have private rights of action, the big private right of action in Ripple, of course, is not, one party against another party. It's a group of parties going after the agency. So the private right of action, John Deaton's case, is to get the courts to have a writ of mandamus, forcing the SEC to stop suing on behalf of investors who are really happy. There is a lawsuit in the crypto space right now that's kind of fun, that is private citizens suing under the federal securities laws for failure to register, and it's in the NFT space. It's the suit against Dapper Labs for their non-fungible tokens in the basketball, the Top Shots. And be interesting to see what happens in that case too.
Yeah, I don't want to touch on it too much because NFTs are sort of like the last frontier as far as where we're going to get to understanding,
There'll be another one.
Yeah. That's true.
Just wait. But,
yeah, no. But I guess the point being just NFTs and are NFT securities?
We probably shouldn't spend too much time on it, but one aspect of the Howey test is proving common enterprise. And an important part of that is that every investor's futures kind of rise and fall together along with the promoter. There's vertical commonality and horizontal, and we don't need to get into that. But the thing about NFTs is each one is putatively unique, in which case maybe you bought a CryptoKitty that breeds really well. I'm way behind on NFTs. I'm still with CryptoKitties. I'm sad. That breeds really well. And someone else has a CryptoKitty that doesn't breed at all. This is all quite weird, but their futures and my futures don't rise together necessarily. So it's going to be harder to prove commonality in the NFT space. And, in the extreme example where like a token is just one, there aren't several NFTs of a series. This is a token that represents ownership rights to this copy of the Constitution or something like that, to look at Constitution data. Then you're really talking about a token that's very much like fine art. It may not be fine in the eyes of a lot of folks, certainly not Brad Sherman, I'd say. But, it's art. And so unless you're going to start arguing that like a Vermeer or a Mona Lisa is a security, it's going to be very difficult to argue that any particular random NFT is a security.
And yeah, taking a step back, a few anonymous audience members have put out a question about whether or not crypto assets are commodities. And I thought this is an interesting point. And Bitcoin is sort of definitely a commodity from sort of like what I know. And I was curious about if anyone wanted to sort of talk about commodities and how they're sort of crypto assets are regulated by the CFTC and how that relates to the SEC's regulation.
I'm happy to just jump in really quick. I mean, if you think about it at a high level, almost anything can be a commodity. And that creates some of the challenge is that you have, to some extent, you've got bifurcation between the two regulators, the two agencies, in terms of who has jurisdiction over which particular asset or instrument. There can also be overlap. And so, you know, the CFTC, absent fraud or retail lending doesn't have jurisdiction over spot commodity transactions. So you have a particular asset that might be a commodity, but the SEC may also say that that has security status as an investment contract. To Peter's point and analysis earlier, like it really just depends, and each one is different. And even if we go to the concept of like an NFT, we could peel layers back and talk about an NFT existing just on its own, fractionalization of that NFT and what that then means. So there are these layers to each of these questions that are pretty significant. We've heard calls from some that there should be a third regulator that actually has jurisdiction over crypto assets, so that neither the CFTC nor the SEC would have that. Many folks have shot that down as completely ludicrous. Like, we can't even get things straight as between the two that exist, let alone having a third. And when would that even happen? It's difficult to get any consensus on Capitol Hill on even some of the smallest issues. So, it's tough. Clients come to us all their time and say, here's what we want to do. What is it? And oftentimes we cannot say definitively what something is. We can advise them on what it might be or what they might have to do to comply with applicable laws. But oftentimes, we're in this gray area. And so the notion that things are incredibly clear and it's blatantly apparent when someone is either stepping over a particular line or about to step over the line, I think that's simplifying things way too much, and it's just not the practical reality of, especially as a practicing lawyer, like what we deal with every single day.
So I was just going to add to the commodities question a little bit more too. So as Nick rightly said, like just about everything's a commodity. So the real operative question is here is does your asset that you're looking at fall out of the securities test? Because if it does, then it's a commodity. Because everything's a commodity. And that doesn't mean the CFTC has jurisdiction over the cash markets for those assets then, because the CFTC has jurisdiction over markets for commodity derivatives, where there's some sort of, relationship between the asset and the commodity, but it's not just me buying the commodity, because the CFTC doesn't go in and regulate cattle auctions. That's a spot market for a commodity, is a cattle auction or a grocery store. Now, the weirdness here is that unlike other commodities, Bitcoin as a digital commodity, because Bitcoin definitely falls out of the securities test, because who is the third party promoter of Bitcoin? There's just lots of people out there. There's no one who we're relying on. It's more like gold. There's a whole bunch of people in the gold industry and in the gold demand side, like scientific uses or jewelry uses, that determine the price of gold. It's not like a share of Apple stock, where it's really Tim Cook and other promoters of Apple that determine the future price of Apple. So take that as a quick answer for why Bitcoin falls out of securities law and is more like gold, more like a commodity, where you just have this diffuse group of participants in the market that determine the price, not a promoter. So then that means it's a commodity, but that doesn't mean you get spot market supervision. Because again, the SEC has a dual mandate. We were going to talk a little bit about the issuing side, like issuers should register with the SEC, and a little bit about the secondary market side. The CFTC doesn't do this secondary market regulation when it comes to just cash markets for commodities. So if your thing's not a security, even if it's trading on retail markets that have a lot of liquidity, like a securities market, it's not going to get regulated by the SEC because the securities exchanges are regulated by the SEC because they're trading securities. So we kind of have this gap where we say, like, well, wait, these markets for things like Bitcoin, they're not securities, so they're not securities markets, but they've got a lot of retail investor exposure, a lot of liquidity, a lot of potential for manipulation. They're not regulated, supervised directly by the CFTC because they're not commodities derivatives markets, they're commodities markets themselves. And so there are actually congressional solutions here that I think are actually worth mentioning. The Digital Commodities Exchange Act was introduced last Congress, is being reintroduced this Congress, would basically say, look, the CFTC can have spot market supervision authority for digital commodities exchanges, because that makes sense, because you've got a lot of retail participation and potential manipulation. And so come register with the CFTC as an exchange that's trading these digital commodities, and we'll put guardrails in place to make sure that there isn't, you know, rampant manipulation or abuse of investors. And I think that's a good approach, actually.
Yeah, it's an interesting point. Nickel from Cato actually pointed out, had a question, which was sort of, does the non-monetary use of gold determining the price have an analog in Ethereum, given its secondary use as a base network for things like DeFi tokens and NFTs?
I think it makes it look a lot like a commodity, because it's kind of, I mean, in Ethereum, they even refer to Ether when it's used to pay for smart contracts as the gas fee. It is a fee, it is literally fuel for running the thing that the Ethereum network is supposed to do, which is executing these so-called smart contracts, which are neither smart nor contracts. They're more like vending machines, but they're useful. You know, they can do cool stuff. You might want to build a decentralized internet application, like a decentralized Facebook. And whenever you use that, instead of paying a corporation or paying them, you know, de facto by giving your eyes for their advertising revenues, you just use the smart contract to tweet or to do the decentralized Twitter equivalent. And then, yeah, you'll need Ether in order to take that action. So it's a commodity that people and corporations and other people will need to do business. And it's like an input to productive activities, very different than just a speculative asset that people passively hold. And so that's another argument, I think a good one, why Ether is not very much like a security, especially the way people seek to use it today.
Although, on the other hand, just because it is clearly a commodity does not mean that the SEC might not come back and say, wait, let's go back to Howey. And in fact, people are holding it, hoping that the folks in the Ethereum community do come up with additional improvements to the Ethereum network, additional improvements to the protocols, and that in fact, it should be regarded as a security, which goes back to the whole question of, Would you please help us figure out in advance so that we know what set of regulations we have to comply with?
But people speculate about commodities too. Like, people probably speculate about rare earth minerals because they think they're going to be used in batteries and in solar panels as the green revolution happens. And they're dependent on people to develop better solar panels and better batteries for the.
Is there an active participant? Is there someone out there that is guiding that you can point to? I mean, that's why I think the SEC is correct under Howey and under, you know, for all practical purposes, we can't find an issuer or an active participant, somebody who's saying, let me promote Bitcoin. I'm the one who wrote the program. I'm the one who started it selling. I'm the one in charge. Okay, maybe Satoshi Nakamoto, but okay, tell me again who that is or who they are or who were they? I mean, we don't know. And so, okay, you've got a computer program. The only thing we really, really, really know about the securities laws is that issuer has to be a person, and computer programs, as of right now, cannot be persons. So there's nobody to go after. In Ethereum, kind of, there are these people who have a whole lot, kind of, a whole lot to do with it. Now, do we know for sure that the SEC is going to change its mind and go after Ether? No. Could they? It could.
Yeah, it gets into sort of this term that's being thrown around, DeNo, decentralized in name only. And it also sort of what the DeFi protocols are wrestling with. So I was just curious if we could sort of direct it that way. What should these DeFi projects, what is the risk there? I think that there's a lot of decentralized quote unquote issuers who are sort of like looking for the correct regulatory policy in this instance.
So I think when we talk about decentralization, it's sort of been a recurrent theme for years now in the blockchain and digital currency space. I think, you know, it's come alive a little bit more recently with the notion of DeFi. I mean, I think, so think about it, you're the SEC for, you know, pushing 100 years now. The entire notion of how you regulate is regulating a particular party or a group of individuals or some central player that is, you know, forming and operating an exchange or issuing securities or registering a fund, right? And in the blockchain space, with the notion of decentralization, that's not the case sometimes. And so I think there's a challenge that the regulators are having of sort of squaring the way their registration regime works today against the emergence of decentralization. Now, the chairman of the SEC, Gary Gensler, has been using the notion of like this analogy of like the duck analogy. If I see a bird and I think it walks like a duck and it quacks like a duck, I call that bird a duck. I don't think he's way off in saying, well, like you can't just call yourself one thing when you really are something else. I don't think anybody really thinks that is going to fly with any regulator or law enforcement body. But if you really are not a duck, then you don't have to call yourself a duck, right? And so I think with decentralization, that is the big issue, is like whether or not, you know, is this really just code that's put out there and then you never touch it again? Or is there, future involvement by any one or many individuals? I think that for the regulator is what they'll really be looking at going forward and currently.
Yeah, I think you can actually see pieces of that right now. In the Ripple case, the SEC didn't just go after Ripple. They named the current and the former CEOs, you know, and that's kind of unusual, not unheard of, but unusual in the securities enforcement area. You see in I know Peter started off by saying the problem from CoinCenter's point of view is, you know, this broad test of who is an issuer. If you look at our infrastructure bill, it's that horribly broad definition of who is a broker that becomes problematic. Because a broker, if you are a broker of a security, you are prohibited from facilitating the transfer of securities unless they're registered. And broker in our Infrastructure Act is defined as anyone who assists in the promotion, distribution, sale of these digital assets. And that could include someone who writes the computer code. It could include the node that does the mining function, because without their services, you couldn't actually have the distribution, the issuance, the sale. And so you have these very broad enforcement mechanisms that developed in a more centralized context, but could easily be translated over to folks who operate, who assist, who work in the DeFi area. And if I was advising, you know, folks who were doing DeFi applications, you start taking a fee for assisting, for you come onto my platform and the protocol will match you up, the, you know, pay a fee to me and you can access this, sort of not quite completely decentralized, but sort of decentralized. And if the SEC can find people to name, to identify, I'd be worried about their reach.
So I wanted to make a small point about the infrastructure bill. We had a whole, lobbying effort underway at CoinCenter to try and narrow that language of the broker definition, because I do think it's problematic. It's worth noting that the broker definition is mostly in the infrastructure bill about the tax law definition of broker, not the securities law definition of broker. So the collateral consequences of an overbroad definition in the infrastructure bill are not more securities regulation. There are more people who have to report from third-party reporting standards to the IRS what their customers are doing. And so if a miner now is treated as a broker and we say that all the transactions the miner puts in a block are their customers' transactions, how could the miner possibly learn about the capital gains of those people? It makes absolutely no sense, and it's just a blunt instrument to do damage to this technology without actually increasing tax revenue or doing anything good in the world. But it's not quite related to securities law, but it very easily could be, Carol. I think you're right, because you know people see that and they see, oh, well, if that's a broker for tax purposes, that could be a broker for securities purposes as well. I think the other thing I wanted to mention is about, we've circled around this topic of how the SEC picks its targets for enforcement. And this kind of came up in the decentralized exchange context already, in the DeFi context already. The SEC, actually before going after anyone who is a centralized exchange like Poloniex, they went after Ether Delta. And they went after a specific guy, his name escapes me at the moment, who was one of the original software developers of the Ether Delta smart contract that allowed people to trade tokens on Ethereum through this smart contract. And he also operated a website that was sort of the front end of his tool. So he was, in a fundamental way, doing something more than just publishing code to the blockchain, but he's just operating a website, right? The weirdest thing about this enforcement action to me is he'd already sold Ether Delta, all the naming rights, the ability to operate the website, to somebody else. And so they found somebody who they could go after who actually has no control over the thing anymore. And they got him. They got him to settle and pay a settlement fine. And I don't know if he admitted guilt or not, to Nick's point earlier, but this is all kind of weird. It's like an effort to make some precedent and some law, even though settlements aren't precedential, that has really very little effect on the world, because Ether Delta was still a smart contract on the Ethereum blockchain that was processing transactions for years after the settlement. And so we have this real problem in that the SEC is just going to pick its victims in the best way that it can, because it's operating under this extremely complex new world where anybody might be able to launch software that could do these things. And it's got a broad interpretation of whether just launching a software tool qualifies as running a national securities exchange and therefore qualifies as unregistered operation of that exchange. This reminds me of the 1990s for a couple of reasons. So in the 90s, there were these message boards where you could be hooked up with someone who wants to buy a share of stock that you own. Stock trading message boards. And they're kind of like Craigslist, which is just an information service provider, but they're also kind of like the NASDAQ or the New York Stock Exchange, because they're matching buyers and sellers. And the SEC actually gave a couple of no action letters back there that said some interesting things. They said some things like, you're not actually a national securities exchange if you're a message board and you charge a flat fee for membership. But if you charge a per transaction fee in order to post messages, buy and sell offers, then you are a securities exchange. And the no action letter, that's also not precedential, but we had this problem back then. This also all reminds me of the 90s, because picking your targets for enforcement in a way that you think you can make maximum impact and scare people so they don't do the things you don't want them to do anymore is exactly what the record industry did to copyright violators in the 1990s who were trading music files on peer-to-peer file sharing networks. And you know, it didn't achieve good results, because what they did was they would find some random target. And in one case, it was a woman who filmed her child dancing to a piece of pop music that she didn't have a license for, and put that video, including the music in the background, up to YouTube. And she got sued for copyright infringement, as if people are going to listen to her YouTube video instead of the original song. And they, you know, this would be bad enough. They tried to get $10 million in statutory damages from her. Why? I think the reason for this, and we were talking about this before we went live on the panel, and so I'll try and be brief because I know I'm going on here, is actually an economist, Gary Becker, who I wanted to bring up because this is a Cato event. Gary Becker has this theory of optimum crime and punishment, where it says if you can't catch every criminal, you catch only 1% of all the criminals, then make the penalty for that one criminal you catch really bad, $10 million statutory damages, so that when any other person is out there thinking like, well, I only have a 1 in 100 chance of getting caught. Oh, but the penalty would be really high. These would-be criminals do an expected cost calculation and they say like, okay, well then I won't commit the crime. This is Gary Becker's theory. It's a good theory. It doesn't actually work. This is a good example, I think, of an economist who has a neat idea that's really cool to talk about in the abstract, but when you apply it to the real world, it's terrible. Why? Because people don't do good expected cost calculations. And so, you know, the would-be criminal's not actually thinking about the likelihood of getting caught, multiplied or divided by the size of the fine. And B, it erodes certainty in the rule of law, because you only see one random woman who videoed her child dancing to music get caught. And you don't see your other friend who's sharing thousands of like episodes of Friends and Seinfeld, and they're not getting caught. And it just makes you think that the whole system is bogus and you shouldn't actually, you know, you shouldn't pay it any mind. It's just stochastically random and abusive of your rights. This is what's going to happen if the SEC tries to run roughshod over the thousands of people developing, you know, technologies on top of Ethereum or networks like it, and arbitrarily picks clients or picks targets and tries to scare everyone else with really big damages. It's just going to erode certainty in the space and do harm. I think we need to think much more carefully about the narrow set of actors who really do fit these definitions, rather than trying to squeeze everyone into that bucket because we're afraid that people are doing crazy things on the internet.
Peter, I don't want to put words in your mouth. I don't think you're suggesting, though, that the SEC literally go after everyone. I think you're making the point that, you know, the process by which they're doing so doesn't seem to make a lot of sense in sort of like, maybe not randomly, but kind of randomly picking who they think are the winners or losers. And again, not trying to put words in your mouth, but, you know, from my view, when I think about having spent a little bit of time at the SEC, the notion of good government. And to me, in this context, good government would be something to the effect of, if you, the SEC, think a particular asset is a security, let that be known. You know, don't keep that a guarded secret within the walls over at F Street next to Union Station. Like, let people know. And there will be effects where, you know, particular assets that are out there trading on secondary markets might crash, right? The price might crash if people think, well, I'm no longer going to be able to have liquidity in that asset. But that's the other notion here, is that like, years have gone by without these proclamations, without guidance saying, we think this and this and this and all of these are securities. It's almost like, in a way, like estoppel through silence, right? Like, if you're not going to tell us that something is, you know, I don't want to say bad, but like a security in your mind, well, if we run an analysis and don't think that it is, it's kind of like the notion of like turning right on red. If it doesn't say you can't turn right on red, you get to turn right on red, at least in Massachusetts. We have a lot of rules for a lot of things here, but like, I can turn right on red if it doesn't say I can't. If I've run an analysis and I don't think something is a security and the SEC hasn't told me, I shouldn't get destroyed for that because maybe I ran the analysis wrong in the agency's mind.
Yeah, I think that's right. And there's a few good pieces of legislation that I'd bring up in this context that are worth mentioning. We either need to create safe harbors for people who are trying to do the right thing and know that there's no way that the SEC will be able to come out and give clarity to each person in each fact pattern. And one good approach there was originally proposed by Commissioner Peirce at the SEC as a safe harbor for developers of these new tokens for 3 years after you do some limited disclosures related to your technology. You are guaranteed not to have an enforcement action against you if you're making credible steps towards being a decentralized token. In other words, yeah, you developed the original software, but now there are other people developing it. Now it's running as a network. You're guaranteed not to have an enforcement action in that window. That provides a little bit of safe zone for people, which reminds me a lot of the safe harbors that were there in the early internet days, when there were lots of unclear rules about, say, copyright liability or defamation liability for third parties. And so that is now a piece of legislation that Congressman McHenry introduced. And I think it's definitely worth considering. Congress has trouble getting anything passed these days, but it's a good piece of legislation. And there's other pieces of legislation that try and set slightly more closely written language. Representative Emmer has a Securities Clarity Act, which tries to tighten up the definition. So it's still a little bit flexible, because to Carol's point, we need flexible standards to catch like scams that are sort of just masquerading as something that's not a security, but it tightens it up with respect to the technology. And there's other approaches that do exactly what you were saying, Nick, where we sort of should, maybe we should switch the default rule so that if the SEC doesn't come out within a certain amount of time and say something, then it is not a security. Right now, we have the inverse for the default rule. Everything's a security until the SEC says it isn't, and the SEC is never in the business of saying that anything isn't a security. And that's kind of a problem.
I thought that a different approach might be to put in there a statute of limitations, because right now there's no limit on how long the SEC can wait to bring an action. I mean, there is for private rights of action, but the SEC, Ripple, can wait, you know, 7-8 years after the tokens are first sold and then go after you. And I would like to see that. honestly, what I'd really like to see, I'm fine with a very, very, very broad definition of what is crypto, so long as there are reasonable exemptions. And the focus of the SEC is where I think it ought to be, which is on the fraud, the manipulation, the misconduct. I think the economic studies that I've seen say the biggest positive impact from SEC enforcement here and around the world where folks copy our actions is in anti-fraud initiatives. So I'm all in favor of a very activist approach there, and much more in favor of reasonable exemptions or limited approaches when it's just register this darn thing.
And we're sort of coming on time. We've got about 10 minutes left. So I just sort of wanted to do concluding remarks, if that makes sense. And just real quick, I'm just curious, sort of thinking in the future, thinking for the next couple of years, what everybody thinks is sort of like a blue sky expectation for what happens versus what's more of a realistic thing to happen. And if we want to game out sort of like whether or not crypto assets will be regulated as securities going forward.
I would love to see Congress do something, almost anything. I don't think a legislative response is particularly likely given how slow they are to act. And if there is a legislative response, I bet it'll be a small one. So I guess, the blue sky, yeah, pass a restricted definition, pass a statute telling the SEC that it's got to have the 3-year safe harbor that was Commissioner Peirce's original proposal. Those would be great. I don't think that's going to happen. So I think more realistically is we will finally at some point find some court that reaches a decision. And I think in 2 years, we'll be in the appellate process. Still working on what is a security under Howey.
So as somebody who used to come to Cato panels eagerly and like ready faced, wanting to ask like daring questions and then not getting called on, when I was an econ student at George Mason many, many years ago, I wanted to, for closing statement, just offer to any students who are watching, like, get involved here. This is an area where we need even more good legal research and economic research. And if this conversation's been interesting, and you believe me that the Howey test actually isn't the problem, I recommend you read an amazing law review article that was written by Judge Easterbrook called Cyberspace and the Law of the Horse, where he said, we don't need new branches of law to deal with new technology because we have no idea what new technology is or will be. And if you taught a course on the law of the horse when horse-drawn carriages were new technology, it would be a really poor way to explain more general principles that have nothing to do with horses, like tort law and property law. And he says that, like, look, we can come up with technology neutral standards that lead to good governance and good rules, even with respect to new technologies. But, and here's the important but, only when the rules of the road are clearly defined, property rights are given, and people can bargain around rules that seem suboptimum because they at least know what the rights are of the parties involved. Then you get cozy in bargaining and then you get efficient outcomes. Even if the roles weren't quite set in the right place, you get negotiations in the private sector to figure it out. And he's saying this with respect to copyright law in the 90s. And I reread it and I was like, wow, I might've been wrong about what I thought about copyright law. Maybe we could have had stronger copyright protections, but clearer rules, and then people would have just created commons because they were efficient and they could bargain towards them rather than just weakening copyright with fair use and things like this. The same stuff is happening now. We don't know which of these things are which, and so we can't see efficient bargaining between parties in the private sector, and that's just gonna be bad for innovation in the long run. So that doesn't answer your questions in general about how do we get clearer rules here, but I think his perspective is just enlightened that the one way to get clear rules is not to have technology specific rules. It's to have better certainty about technology neutral standards like the Howey test. But as Carol said, that might take years.
And I'll take a kind of different spin. Peter, you mentioned rules of the road. I wanna see a clearer path. And most of the clients that I support They're not arguing with the notion of come in and get registered. They just want to know how they do that. And so I'm not going to make any predictions because I always guess wrong. I'm not a betting man. But what I hope is that those paths become a lot clearer and that we start to learn when the regulators say, like, come in, not only talk to us, but register with us, how we go about doing that. Because those roadblocks have come up more often and there just really don't seem to be ways to get through those right now. So hopefully in 22, we actually learn how to get through that.
Yeah, and we've got about 4 minutes left. So just like a lightning round. Peter, I liked your point about sort of encouraging people how they can learn more. And I guess I just throw that to Nick or Carol too. You guys had any sort of recommendations about places to start, books to read, podcasts, anything?
I mean, honestly, you know, Peter's shop is a great place to just subscribe to anything and everything. I think the thing that we probably should have touched on more than we did today, and we really didn't at all, is just how incredibly exciting the innovation is that exists in this space. It's unlike, you know, people talk about Web 3.0. It's been a long time since we've seen the kind of innovation that we've seen in the blockchain and crypto space. As a lawyer who advises on really old laws and regs, it's been reinvigorating. I still advise on those same old laws and regs, but I'm applying them to this whole new space that didn't exist from kind of a sort of formalized legal standpoint 5, 6, 7 years ago. So it's been incredibly exciting. I would just say, be a sponge, like absorb anything and everything you possibly can and reach out to people. When you see someone that is maybe doing interesting and creative things, most people in this space are really, really giving of their time and their experience and their insight. Peter is, Carol, myself, don't be shy, reach out and try to learn as much as you can.
Yeah. For the students, I was going to say, if you're a law student and you're in an environment where there are courses in blockchain or crypto, my God, take them. Because most of the law that you will study, if when you go out and you become a lawyer, you will be 30 years behind the lawyers who've been practicing 30 years, 20 years behind the lawyers who've been practicing 20 years, and ahead of most of them in the crypto space the moment you step out, if you have taken the time as a student to learn. But don't stop learning. Don't take the course and then think, phew, I got that, I can put that aside, because this dynamic space is moving quickly.
I just wanted to add one last thing to Nick's point about the technology reinvigorating the space of legal endeavor here. I think sometimes people come to this space and they make a slight mistake. They say, this technology needs to be regulated differently, when maybe the technology is just revealing issues with how things were regulated before when they're done using the technology. So it's not the technology. It's that actually when people became interested, young people, especially vibrant people, became interested in investing in things, they realized that there's this accredited investor rule that doesn't give them access to a lot of unique products. And that was an investor protection protocol that was put in place that said, if there's no registration at the SEC, you have to be a millionaire in order to buy this thing. And, you know, there's real protections that offers, but there's a lot of costs in people being unable to access exotic investment opportunities, and where rich people get the best end of the stick, basically, because they're allowed to participate early. And so maybe what we've discovered is that is a problem, the accredited investor rule. That's a problem with securities law that the technology is revealing. That's not a problem about the law not applying well to technology. It's that the law in its foundation was actually wrong, and nobody noticed until the technology came along and made people interested in those harder questions of things like investor protection.
Well, thanks, everybody. That's a great way to end it. And Jennifer?
Great. I want to thank everyone so much for joining us today. And thank you for the great panel. It was a great discussion. And I know that there are a lot of topics we didn't get to and a lot of questions from the audience that we didn't get to either. Thank you so much to the audience for being engaged and for joining our discussion about how we regulate in this space. If you missed our discussions about the CFTC and banking regulators, you can check out the recordings, which are available on Cato's website. We will return in January 2022 with the final panel in our series, where we will discuss proposals for a crypto regulatory framework. And we'll be very excited to put up the registration for that in the coming weeks. Until then, thanks again and have a great afternoon.